All right, hi. This I can't even. See, it's like now I have to talk, and
This is why I'm actually. Part of me is glad I'm not in the same room as you, because I would not be able to stop giggling.
Yeah, that's true. I
don't have the video on because my camera is not working, so it's not going to stream any video right now.
Because I'm not dressed. So,
well, there's also that. Yeah, right. Yeah.
I actually am not wearing any pants.
Straight up Porky Pig in it. I have a shirt on, and that's it. And on that note, welcome to the podcast.
This is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about modern, brand new aftermarket games for retro consoles. On this podcast, we pick one game a month to play and talk about. Today, we are not going to have a game. Today is our introductory episode. My name is Nick, also known as Divertov, and joining me today are...
Yes, this is Bart L. Frank on Instagram. I am clever. Username needed.
And Connor Nash on Twitter as Connor Nash.
Okay, guys, this week... We are not talking about a game. This week, we are going to do an episode where we just talk about ourselves. And so the point of this is to have this episode up as like a point of reference. If somebody jumps into the podcast at some point, they can go back and find out who are these guys and why do they have the terrible opinions that they do. And so I want to talk a little bit first about the format of the podcast and then kind of jump into maybe our experiences with video games and why we are interested in homebrews specifically. But before we get started, I did want to define homebrew. Like, what do we mean when we say that? And so when I'm talking about homebrew games, what I mean is specifically these are original games, brand new, made from scratch for video game consoles that are past the end of their life. So aftermarket games. And these games use all new assets. They're not reused from existing games. So they're not hacks. Sometimes they're put out on physical releases. Sometimes they're not. They're just distributed digitally. But hacks, with a hack, you're taking an existing game and you're modifying it somehow. Maybe it's just a little gameplay tweak here and there. Maybe it's like in creating an entirely new game. You know, maybe you want to make Super Mario Brothers, but you want Mario to be the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. That's not the kind of game that I'm talking about. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not the point of this podcast. The point of the podcast is to go back and find these new games made for these old consoles and play them as players and just talk about them and get to know these really interesting homebrew communities that are out there.
Not gonna lie, I'd play the shit out of Super Stay Puft Marshmallow Bros.
That would be kind of fun. I'm sure there's probably a hack like that out there. If you go to ROM hacks, there's romhacking.net. There's got to be something like that out there.
So what's the difference, like technically, between a ROM hack and a homebrew game? Then is it that you're just because you're starting from scratch? Is that just like a whole other level of effort? Is it a whole other like approach to doing it? Or is that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not trying to make an artistic judgment on anyone who's doing ROM hacks. You know, if we did a podcast about ROM hacks, there are like literally tens of thousands of those out there, probably. So, I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start with those. There's nothing wrong with cracking open a file to Super Mario Brothers and saying, I want to reskin this, or I want to change the colors around, or, you know, something like that. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it's to say like, no, I want to create a new platformer from scratch using all new assets that I've created myself. I mean, to me, that's like creating a game, right? That's making a game instead of just tweaking somebody else's existing game.
Yeah, the former feels like you're just like modding Skyrim or something like that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I
think that's a reasonable,
valid thing to do, but yeah.
Sure.
Like there's like podcasts about mods, there's podcasts about games, and those are two different things. People understand that. Homebrews are not homebrews are not mods. They are games of their own right.
Yes. At least that's what I say when I use the word. Now, some people do, when they say homebrews, they mean hacks as well. And that's why I thought it'd be important to just put that out there up front, that we're not talking about that. So the format of the podcast, at least in the beginning, is going to be on a monthly schedule. I think that is probably all we can handle right now. Is that right, guys?
I think so.
Sounds good.
So we're going to pick one game and we're going to play the hell out of it for a month. And I say play the hell out of it. You know, that's the thing is this is a game club. This is a game club format. And so if we pick a game and you get to a point where you can't play the game anymore, then that's your experience with the game. And when we come in to talk about it, then you can say, like, I hit a wall with this game and I could not play it anymore. So on that note, though, I do want everybody to have honest opinions about these. However, we, the three of us, all realize that these are made as labors of love. They're very rarely made for any type of monetary gain. You know, no, most people aren't getting paid for these. So I want everybody to be honest with their opinions, but also considerate, because we're critiquing things that aren't usually professionally made.
Yeah, I don't want to come in and just torch some game that a couple of guys spent like 6 months of their life just like sweating over, and think they put it out into the world and think, man, I love this game. This is great. And then I'm like, oh, it's fucking hard. I played it for 15 minutes, couldn't get anywhere. Fuck this game. No, I'm not going to do that. That's, yeah, no.
Yeah, and you know, it, just because we might dislike something doesn't mean it's a bad game. It might mean that we just have bad opinions. So.
Yeah, you know, it's possible. Probably more likely the case.
So yeah, at least one of us, when we play through this game, so we're playing through games that are made for retro consoles. So we're talking about like the NES, original Game Boy, Sega Master System, Super Nintendo, Mega Drive. I mean, when possible, at least one of us is going to try to play the game on original hardware. That might be difficult for some of these consoles. It's usually probably going to be me. You guys don't collect consoles, but we'll get to that. But I think that's important. I think that if people are making games for a specific console, you owe it to them to at least try to play it on that console. So
I would also love to try to get together and play whatever game we're talking about for that month together for an evening. Just, you know what I mean? Yeah. That would be lovely to be able to get in the same room. And because, you know, like I found whenever I was playing a certain game that we'll be talking about later, you know, I feel like I've hit a wall right now.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, if I'm in a room with you guys and you're like, no, just try this, you know, that might break open the wall and might help me get a little farther or not get so frustrated with a certain game.
Yeah. And that might give us some opportunity to post maybe videos to YouTube or.
Yeah. I'm thinking that as well for like. Twitch stream or something, because then it can be even more collaborative, right? Because you can have other people playing at home or watching you play.
So I will tell our audience that our podcast is probably going to be focused on the NES, the Nintendo Entertainment System, here at first. And that is for one reason. Well, it's for a couple reasons. I think, first of all, it's the console that three of us, of these retro consoles, the one that the three of us are most familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the one that, of the three of us, the one who collects the games has the biggest backlog. But we do eventually hope to expand to other consoles. And, you know, please understand, if you are listening to this, if we've got quite a few episodes into this and you're coming back and you're listening to this and like, none of this sounds right. These guys, what you know, the format may change over time. Like things may adapt. We may find that there are different ways that we want to do this. But in the beginning, this is where we're coming from. And this is what we intend the focus of the podcast to be.
Yeah, I mean, if this ends up being a cooking podcast, I'm sure we'll re-record this episode.
Yeah. Or you'll cherish this episode as being the real authentic episode and everything else was trash.
Right. It's all downhill from here, folks. This is the best.
Episode zero is the peak.
Episode zero, right. Okay, so we're going to go into this next section now. We're going to talk about our own history with the video games. The reason for this section is... You know, I want people to understand like what we, each of us kind of brings to the table. I think especially with retro video games, there's so much like nostalgia wrapped up in it and our own histories with it, that it's probably important to at least have a background on where each of us comes from this. Because I think we all have very different experiences, actually, or at least Connor, yours is very different from the two of us. I tell you what, why don't one of you start? Because I've been talking a lot now, so...
Yeah, I'm happy to start. It's I can trace my video game experience back to probably whenever I was 3 or 4 years old, watching my cousin play Space Invaders on my grandma's Atari 2600.
Wow.
It blew my mind. Like, you can control that thing on the screen? What is that how, let me try, you know, and I remember trying it and failing and trying it and failing. And then they said, get out of the room. And then every time I went over to my grandma's house, I'd be like, can I play that thing? Now, flash forward a few years, my parents bought me a Nintendo Entertainment System. I think it was probably the year it came out because I got the deluxe edition, which had the robot and it had the gun, you know, and I was hooked, man. I did have Rob, and I had Gyromite, and I tried like hell to make him work, and it was such a pain in the ass. Which
yeah,
I think
terrible.
That's,
they don't
that's,
work at all.
Yeah, it's kind of the consensus there, but and I think because my parents bought me the Nintendo, I was a Nintendo guy. I never bought a Sega anything. I never had a Dreamcast, never had a Master System, Genesis, none of that. I got the Nintendo. I got the Super Nintendo when it came out in the 90s. I bought a Nintendo 64. I had a GameCube. I had a Wii. I didn't get the Wii U. I have the Switch now. Whenever I was a child, though, I spent as much time as I possibly could in an arcade. I loved video games in the arcade and pinball. I was a big pinball freak when I was a kid, which has followed me into adulthood as well as the video gaming. The big thing about the arcade for me was, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, but whenever I would go into the arcade, to me, that was like the state of the art of the time. Like everything that I would play on a console, I always compared it to the arcade.
Well, right, because it was the best stuff that was out there.
Yeah, best of the best. Oh, you know, and I also had, in addition to playing, you know, the Nintendo, you know, I got hooked on Metroid. I got hooked on Legend of Zelda. For the Nintendo 64, I was all about Mario 64 and trying to get, it was like being a completionist. And this was also, I think the Nintendo 64 came out in what, 1996, which I was a senior in high 64? School then.
Yeah, that was sounds about right.
Yeah, so that was like what I would play in college. When I got together with my college buddies, we played GoldenEye, and we played Turok. From here on out, most of my video gaming experience revolves around something that I saw with you, Nick, because I remember I went to your apartment and I saw that you had a PS2 and we played some kung fu game where we were like samurai warriors, and I was hooked on that game, and I bought a PS2 specifically to buy that game and play it, and I knew that it had a DVD player in it, so I was like, oh, that'll be a double deal. I can talk my girlfriend into this. You know, like if we're it's not a waste of money if it's a DVD player too, whatever.
Well, I think that's why everybody bought one. That's the best-selling console of all time.
Yeah. And from then on out, I was PlayStation. Yeah. I was all about PlayStation. I never got an Xbox until about 8 months ago when I got my first 4K TV, and that was the cheapest 4K Blu-ray player I could find was an Xbox One S. So that sits up in my living room with my TV so that I can play 4K Blu-rays. But other than that, I'm playing PlayStation today. I've got, you know, PS2, 3, 4, and now I have a 5. And I think that's my personal history with video games. I've pretty much started with the Atari 2600, and every single new generation, I bought a console, whether it was the Nintendo console or PlayStation, starting with the PlayStation 2. I've pretty much been playing video games ever since I was 3 years old.
So what do you look for in a game? Like, what's your favorite type of game?
You know, it used to be, before I had children, I wanted a game that had the most bang for the buck. And I think that came whenever I started playing, Legend of Zelda. This is early, early, early. Like, Legend of Zelda to me was a huge game. And there was so much that you could do, and it was an open world game, and it was just like this crazy new concept to me. And I loved that, and I loved Metroid. Because there was so much to do for the price of that game. You know, whereas you get Super Mario Brothers, I was good at Super Mario Brothers. I won a contest playing Super Mario Brothers back in the day. I actually got like the highest amount of points that you could get in 30 minutes, and I ended up winning a copy of a video game at a little fair in my hometown. And I think, Nick, you were there.
Yes. It was before we knew each other, but I was there. Yeah,
it was a long time ago. So I was really good at Super Mario Brothers, and I beat it real quick, and I got tired of it. This was, you know, way before speed running. I'm sure if that had been a thing, I probably would have been into that. But I just thought, okay, well, cool, that game's done. I'll throw that one on the pile and move on to something else. So I've always looked for something that was the biggest bang for the buck, which is why I was probably really, really into Super Mario 64, because that game was huge. and then what was the other game? Oh, Grand Theft Auto 3. When that came out, I was a roommate, a mutual friend of ours. We lived together, and we played Grand Theft Auto 3 every day after work. It was huge, an open world, and it felt like you could do anything. There was just so much play value for the money. And I don't know, that's value for the money is an interesting way to put it, but, and that's kind of still where I'm at now. Like I would always want to go for like, you know, the Grand Theft Autos and the Red Dead Redemptions and anything that was a big open world game, the bigger, the better, Breath of the Wild, all of that, until I had to start dealing with my children. And I realized that I don't have that much time to put into video gaming anymore, but I still want to do it. So I need to do something that's a little more casual and a little more, I could just pick it up, play a little bit and put it down. And that's when I got into like these battle royale games. I started playing a battle royale game on my phone. I loved it.
Are you going to confess to playing Fortnite now?
Yeah.
Is this the part in the podcast where you tell everybody that you're a Fortnite player?
This is the part in the podcast where I tell everybody that I play Fortnite. Yes.
We just lost half our audience.
See you guys. You don't like Fortnite?
That's what you did, Bart. Thanks a lot.
Right, we're going to lose the other half when I say that I like casual games. So don't worry.
Oh, there they go. Yep.
Everybody's gone. Sweet. Now that everybody's gone, let's talk about Fortnite. No, I'm just kidding. The point is, whenever I want to just like turn off my brain for a half an hour, I'll jump in and play a round of Battle Royale. And that's kind of where I'm at right now with video games, except for the occasional homebrew, which I will get into whenever that comes around.
Which is a game that I make you play.
I wouldn't say that it's a game that you make me play, because honestly, if I'm going to get into that right now, when you told me, I don't know, it was a couple of years ago, we were at your house.
Well, hold on. Let's not get to playing homebrew games. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
So, Connor, do you want to go next?
Sure.
What is your personal history with video games? Because this is, I want to hear this because your background is very different from Bart and I. Bart and I like literally grew up in the same town and we were about the same age. Your experience with video games is very different. Because not only are you younger than us, but you grew up in a different part of the world.
Yeah, where... I mean, not like too crazy, but I was in Ireland. I grew up in Dublin.
You're in Ireland?
I was.
Oh my God, are you Irish?
I can't even tell from your accent.
Holy shit, kind of gone.
I feel like I'm just meeting you for the first time. It's amazing.
It's a special moment we're sharing. I was born in the 80s in Ireland, which was a time of a lot of change and a lot of things happening in Ireland, but not a lot of imported electronics equipment. So while I was aware of the Nintendo, and actually more so than the Nintendo console, the Game Boy was absolutely what captured my imagination. I was desperate to get a Game Boy, and I begged my parents to get me a Game Boy, and instead they bought me a guitar to get better at playing guitar. And that was a lot of fun, you know, in my teenage years. But as a child, I just was, you know, in tears that I couldn't play a Game Boy. I was obsessed with that console.
We're talking about the original, the green dot matrix screen Game Boy, the DMG. Okay.
And I had a friend who had, what was it, Mario World 2. It was the one where you use a strawberry to get the flight power. It was a really weird game, really interesting game. And I really wished I had a Game Boy. And so my parents did see after they bought me the guitar how sad I was not having a Game Boy. And they said, oh, he deserves to have something fun. Okay. So they said, Connor, we decided we're going to get a machine that you can play games on. And it's an IBM 386 PC.
Nice.
So instead of a handheld console, it is a air conditioner that, when it turns on, sucks all the air out of the room and uses these floppy disks. Don't worry, you'll understand all of this as a 7-year-old, exactly what's going on. We had this idea, my dad in particular had this idea, that the PC was the way forward. And obviously he was kind of right. But at the time, it was not as much fun as a console, because the games that were for that were very much aspiring to be Nintendo games. Because Nintendo games absolutely set the bar for what was a quality game, what was fun to play, what was engaging. And the platformers that I played, like Commander Keen, were still regarded very well and still to this day have a cult following, but nowhere near the same level of quality and just gameplay as Nintendo games. So I kind of was partially interested in games, but more so interested in the technology. So when I finally had enough money saved to buy a game console, I actually bought a Game Gear. The main reason why was because it had a TV tuner. Right. So I could actually watch TV on it. And that kind of tangential interest in gaming has kind of like followed me, where as I finally realized what a you know, what your game console could be when the Nintendo 64 came around, and I really decided to invest in that and really started to understand just how much fun gaming could be at that level. I had already had really interesting experiences with gaming where you are asking Bart, like, what's kind of like, what's your go-to game? Like, what kind of games do you like? And that has just changed so much over time. Like, when I had that PC experience, it was platformers and really experimental games, like the first ever 3D chess game and things that were point-and-click adventures like Monkey Island or Police Quest. And then a lot of the experience that Bart was talking about with the Atari was this really wild feeling of like, wow, you can actually affect what's on the screen. And then, wow, that actually looks kind of real. And wow, I've never seen something do something like that. Like, I still remember playing Super Mario 64 for the first time, and my eyes almost went out of focus trying to understand what 3D meant compared to any other game that you've played.
And I feel like anybody younger than us is not going to get that.
And I think Mario 64 honestly has not aged that well. Like, if you go back and look at it now, I mean, knowing that that's where 3D games really started. I don't know that was the first 3D game, but, you know, that was a landmark in 3D games.
For sure.
I think that to a younger generation now, that would be really hard to put yourself in a place where you can. Yeah, because I don't feel like it's aged that well. But I think it's interesting that that was such a big influence on both of you.
Oh, yeah. Hugely. Well,
also, the idea of controlling something on a screen is probably something that like a lot of people, younger people than us, wouldn't get, because for the first few years of my life, that was so rare, you know, but now it's everywhere.
We all grew up in such a television, like broadcast television heavy culture, mm-hmm. that we were so inured to consuming media. The idea of interacting with media was wild. Was just like another level for so many people. And I don't think an older generation understood how jarring that was, because they'd been, for them, broadcast was the crazy thing. And broadcast, like high definition media of like visuals and music. But for us, interacting was just that extra level. And then as I grew through that medium and grew super interested in the internet and internet culture and things like that, and I ended up moving to San Francisco, and finding that at the time that I moved to San Francisco, casual games and things like mobile games, like the iPhone released in 2007. And so mobile gaming just absolutely skyrocketed from 2009, 2010 onwards. And then really trying to look at those games as another art form, because there's things you can do in that. And I know there's a lot of games that people would regard as being very commercial or not true games, but there was a great indie scene for mobile games at that time, with the inputs that you could use, the fact that it was haptic. And I remember there was a game which literally had a high score of how high you could throw your phone in the sky.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And like, it sounds so silly.
Were broken because of that game.
Right. But like that sense of frivolity, of novelty, of doing things has always been the thing that interested me in games. And so now that I'm older and, you know, like Bart said, we have kids and things like this, I come back to the homebrew and I still see that sense of novelty. I still see that sense of pushing things to be a new idea, to do something new, because sometimes with technology, it's where the commercial interest hasn't yet caught up, is where the artistic interest and the really interesting ideas can take flight.
So Connor, I did want to ask you. So we're going to be talking specifically about homebrews for consoles that, especially in the beginning here, consoles that were kind of before your time. So sure. if we're talking about the Master System or the NES, I actually saw a thing on Twitter a couple of days ago where it was market share in the United Kingdom in like 1993. And it was fascinating because I believe the top of the market with like 30% market share, and this is totally off the top of my head. I think it was Commodore 64.
Probably, yeah.
And then under that was Amiga. And then way down at the bottom with like 2% market share was the NES. And this was like in 92 or 93. So this would have been like near the end of that thing's life cycle.
Sure.
What's so interesting to me is that so many of these homebrewers right now who are just making the best stuff are coming out of Europe, where the NES just really never took off. So I'm going to be interested to hear your take on this, because I feel like as somebody who didn't grow up with it, you're not going to have nostalgia goggles like Bart and I will. So,
well, I mean, there's a couple of tints of nostalgia that I think are important. It's just that the Nintendo console arrived in Europe in a very different way at a very different time with a very different culture consuming it. So by the time the Nintendo console was even released in Europe, most of the original cadre of games had been released. And so there was a massive back catalog. So it wasn't very obvious to somebody who was buying a Nintendo game what game they should buy with it, or to the stores what they should stock. And so it was really when Mario Brothers 3 came along that that was like, oh, now I know what to do with this.
Okay, this one's good. You can start here.
Right? Like that's where you begin with Nintendo. The problem, of course, being that Super Mario Brothers 3 is effectively the apex of the technical achievement of what you can do with a NES. So from there, everything kind of feels like a step backwards. Also pair that with the kind of cultural idea of my father, or if you imagine a British or German father thinking, well, it's great that my son can play games, but I also want him to understand how to make a spreadsheet. So platforms like the Commodore or the Sinclair ZX Spectrum, things like this, they were more open to being able to be used for productivity software or other types of software, though gaming became kind of the killer app for them. So those kinds of platforms ended up being more popular, even though they kind of hamstrung the commercial audience, because it was only the hardcore fans that were able to get the most out of it. Because if you think of a Commodore 64 or something like that, you loaded the games on by audio cassette. So
that fascinates me.
If you were trying to play a game, you'd say, okay, I've got to load this game into the memory of this system. So I just have to press play on this audio cassette and wait 35 minutes for it all to be read by the computer. So I'll just come back in 30 minutes and play this game. And I cannot express how the European mentality of like, I'll just go and get a coffee and chat with my friends while I'm waiting for this to happen, compared to an American mentality of, I want to play this now, click, click, let's go, it explains some of that difference.
Well, and now you have people like screaming like tortured children or something when they have to wait for a load screen that's longer than like 5 seconds.
Right. And I want to say there was something there about the cultural aspect. At the same time, I understand that there were other components of that. I'm just looking back through the lens that I have and now having lived in the United States for 10, 12 years and seeing these comparisons raised in kind of relief of how I experienced that at the time.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you feel like these people that are coming out of Europe making these homebrew games are doing it from a place of maybe feeling like they missed out on the original release and like getting excited about a new game?
I mean, I haven't been as involved in the homebrew scene as Nick or some other people, so I am reluctant to make a sweeping statement. Right. I just know that the NES console, from a technical angle, and this is again kind of my perspective on this, is coming back to the NES console, looking at it technically, it's such a jewel of technical achievement, both for its time and even now in the future, where you look at how code is written for it, what you can write and what can be done technically with it. And it's like a canvas that gives you a lot of artistic freedom while at the same time constraining you to being within this world. If you were looking at something like the PlayStation or the Sega Saturn, you can do so many more things, but it's very difficult to even approach making a game for those platforms because it's technically orders of magnitude more difficult. For the NES, there's so much out there that allows you to just get started making that game. And then once you've done that, you kind of start to, I want to say, like, really live in that world and live in what that kind of feels like. And to the development community in Europe, I think that's something that's really appealing, that like not only the community can be felt around it, but that it has its own flavor. You can't make NES games for anything other than the NES. It just has this unique flavor. You know a NES game when you see it, compared to, say, Master System or PC games of that time.
Well, I don't know about Master System. I would say definitely for something like a Super Nintendo, though. Like a lot of Super Nintendo games, to me, at least on the surface, look pretty much identical to a lot of modern indie games. They don't have a lot of definition to me that makes them stand out as, oh yeah, that's definitely a Super Nintendo game.
Right. I would say with the exception of like Mode 7 graphics.
Oh, of course. Mode 7, right.
And that's a very specific chip that, again, was very technically difficult to use. So you had a very limited set of developers who could get anything out of it. The N64, unfortunately, is one of the worst examples of this, where there was this microcode aspect where if you knew exactly how the chips of the N64 worked, you could get these magical things to happen. And that's how Rare were able to get incredible games that it seemed like other third-party developers weren't able to achieve because they just didn't know the secret sauce.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to see a really vibrant Nintendo 64 homebrew community, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And that's in spite of the Nintendo 64 having multiple genre-defining games.
Yeah, it's my turn. I'm going to try to keep this as concise as possible. So, yeah, as I was saying, I think each of us bring something a little bit different to the table, even though I should clarify for anybody who hasn't figured it out right now, or maybe we've already said it in the podcast, I don't know, but Bart and I grew up in the same hometown. We didn't know each other until high school, but we grew up probably 2 or 3 miles from each other, something like that.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah, so you're just a couple years older than me. And first video game console I ever played, I played an Atari 2600. First console that I ever owned was an NES. Super Mario Brothers, I totally changed my life. But the thing I think where my experience is different is my family actually owned and operated video rental stores, which, you know, I feel like I have to explain these to anybody listening to this who didn't grow up with them. There may actually be people listening to this who did not grow up with video rental stores. Is that possible? I guess it's possible.
Maybe. I can tell you that your video rental stores were the best ones in town. That's the ones we went to.
Yeah, hell yeah, they were. They were a hell of a lot better than those assholes Blockbuster down the street. But I know the what that does is, you know, I mean, I grew up literally surrounded by video games. I mean, we had like stacks of video games at my house because the way that video rental stores worked is that you would buy whatever was popular, you know, and you would have it on the show. You might have multiple copies of it, and then you would keep them on the shelf until they stopped renting. And then you would only have so much real estate on the shelf. So you would pull the games off, and then you would either, you know, you could sell them to your customers, or they might end up at the home of the owners and in the kids of the owners and their personal game collection. Yeah, I had a whole lot of mediocre Nintendo games that people didn't want to rent anymore, covered in rental stickers. And so that's why today when I buy these things and they have rental stickers on them, I actually don't mind it. It's, it kind of fills me with nostalgia because, you know, that's how I knew games. Growing up like that, I got to try a lot of different games. I can remember one interesting moment was because my dad had all these industry connections, I ended up with, it was an unlabeled game. It had like a piece of masking tape on it. And it said Baby Mario in marker on the masking tape. And my dad's like, check this out. This is some game that was released in Japan. And it was never released in the United States. So just play this, like see if it even works. I have no idea if it even works. We put it in and it turned out it was a dump of a Famicom Disk System game called Biomiracle Bokute Upa. And that is a game where you are a baby and you crawl around with a little baby rattle and you hit enemies with your rattle and they blow up like balloons. And the game is very strange and surreal. There's a level where you eat your way through cake. And there's candy, and it's like the whole game is like baby themed. It's a really bizarre, surreal, and interesting game. And I didn't know any of this when I was a kid. I was sitting there playing this thing, and I was probably like 8 years old, and my mind was completely blown. And that
my mind is blown right now, Nick.
Yeah, something spoke to me about this. I'm like, there's an entire world of video games out there that I don't even know about.
Right.
You know, so I think that is where, yeah, having that experience of growing up in a rental store and like knowing people who worked in this industry, you know, I think that it just changed my perspective on it in a way that maybe my peers didn't get to experience.
Right. I mean, I had a similar, well, that's my point is that it's not similar, but I had an experience that reminds me of that when I was much older, when I was attending Game Developers Conference in San Francisco or E3 in LA due to the work that I was doing in casual games. I mean, that wasn't like, I wasn't 8 years old. I was in my 20s and like had a very different perspective on what gaming was due to a whole bunch of other things. My mind was blown by a lot of things that happened there, but not in any way similar to what you're describing, because it was so formative. It was so based on what your preconceived ideas of what could be done with technology were. And, you know, again, you were in that smaller, more parochial environment where you maybe didn't see a wider world around you except for this one avenue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, also, as far as being a kid and having, I had a very few number of video games, you know, because it was like $50 for a new game. And if $50
back then was a hell of a lot of money.
Too. Yeah. And
that's
so like
$100 today.
If my mom was going to be like, all right, well, we're going to reserve the buying of the games for like Mario 2, Mario 3. If we can find one on sale, that's fine too. But for the most part, you're just going to rent. So anytime I got to branch out from like the five or six basic games that I had, it was going to your store and renting, and I would have it for a day or two, and then I have to take it back. And maybe sometimes I'd be like, oh, I loved that game, I'm going to have to go rent that. You know, and it got to a point where I would coordinate with my neighbors. What games do you have? There's this new game coming out. Are you going to get that? Because if you're not going to get it, I might try to talk my mom into getting it. You know, and we would just kind of trade our games back and forth. So, you know, we had like this little network of trading games and being able to play different things. But you just had a pile of games there that you could.
It's true.
Yes. You could look at. That's got to be a very different experience.
I was definitely a spoiled kid. And I mean, that probably influenced my decision to become a collector later, at least a lightweight collector. I was such a spoiled kid, in fact, that I was the one kid who had the TurboGrafx-64, which is kind of notorious as a video game console that only spoiled kids owned. But yeah,
You mean TurboGrafx-16?
TurboGrafx-16. Did I say that? Jesus.
Yeah, you said 64.
You said 64.
Oh, man, right. You were so spoiled. You had the TurboGrafx-64? Like, there's only three of those.
Yeah, okay. So if I don't even know. Maybe I'll leave that in. I'm telling you, folks, we're recording at night, and wow. Yeah, all right. I loved it so much. I don't even remember what the hell it was called.
Yeah, I loved it so much.
Like, look, I was a spoiled kid. Who gives a shit? Right? I threw it on the fucking pile, okay? Yeah.
You've seen MTV Cribs? I was like that, except just
I was like
consoles.
That. Yes, just piles of them, literally. No, there were actually literally piles of NES games in my house. But yeah, and after that, you know, I went to Super Nintendo. I never went down the Genesis path. I was never a Sega guy. I didn't come to appreciate Sega until I was much older and emulating games.
Me either.
Went to Nintendo 64. And I honestly, I have a few games that I remember from that period. I wasn't too into it. I played some games on PC too. I really enjoyed some PC games.
You know,
honestly,
I was going to say, I think I played a couple of PC games like in the very early days of like Windows 95, because this is going back to something that Connor had said. Like, I remember convincing my parents to get a computer because I would, quote unquote, do my homework on it, which would be like, I don't know.
Such a great excuse, wasn't
learning
it?
Learning Microsoft Excel or something. But really,
I don't know
to
if
play.
Kids can use that excuse anymore.
Probably not.
I did that. My dad actually had me like draw up a sales pitch, and he's like, all right, if you want this thing, you got to work for it.
Yeah.
So I mean, like if it had been a thing at the time, like he probably would have had me like do like a PowerPoint slide deck of like why I should get a computer, you know, and it apparently it worked because my first computer was an IBM 486. But honestly, I got to where I kind of, I had a, you know, PlayStation 2, I had a PlayStation 3. I was in a phase for a while where I wasn't playing video games at all. I think there was a period of maybe like 5 or 6 years where I only played maybe 3 or 4 video games. I played Fallout 3, Fallout New Vegas, and NHL hockey. That's it. And, you know, I may have played several NHL hockey games, but they're all the same, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, that's pretty much all I played. Indie games on computer, that's pretty much it. And it was not until, I guess, around 2015, I was in grad school at the time. By that point, we had just had our second kid, and I commute a lot for work, and I was completely overwhelmed, and I needed a hobby that I could just not think about at all, that took no mental energy at all. And right about that time, I found an NES in an old vinyl bag from one of our rental stores. We used to, you could actually go, if you didn't have the console, you could go to the rental store and rent the actual console. And I had the NES was in perfect condition, a perfect console. I mean, I guess it had not ever been used. You know, maybe we got it and nobody ever rented it or something. But yeah, it was in perfect condition. And so I went online and I'm like, you know, I want, the only game I want is Contra. That's it. That's the only game I want. So I go on eBay and I get Contra and I fell down a hole of I started building RetroPies. If you know what that is, that's a tiny computer that all it does is emulates old video games. And the next thing you know, I'm building RetroPies. Bart, I built one for you. I built like a dozen of these things. I got super into this. I got addicted to eBay and I started buying games. And now I would say I'm a lightweight collector. I'm not too into it. I have, between NES and Famicom, I probably have about 400 games, and that's including my homebrew. But maybe that sounds like a lot to you guys, but I know that I follow a lot of collectors on Instagram or whatever, and I mean, they've got tens of thousands of games. So 400 is pretty lightweight, but I'm pretty proud of the collection that I've got. So I think that's what I bring to the table is I've got this background with these rental stores and I am the one collector among the three of us. So whereas you guys don't really collect games at all, if I'm correct.
No, not at all. We enjoy playing the games that you collect.
I do enjoy playing, and I remember
playing the games that I collect. Yes.
Because I remember that night I came to your work, and you were like, "Check this thing out," and you were like, "I got Contra just now," and we started playing it, and it was like it took me back. Because I had played an old school NES in forever.
That was probably 5 years ago.
Probably. And I just remember every single NES that I had seen for probably the 10 years prior to that. If you put a game into it and turned it on, it would just blink and it wouldn't work. Because I had three of them and they all broke. And so I threw them away. And that was me being stupid, like 2001 or 2002, just getting rid of them. But you had this one that was in perfect freaking condition. And I remember going home and telling my wife that, like, oh my God, I played Contra whenever I talked to Nick about this thing we were doing. And then it was like 6 months later, you're like, hey, look at this giant pile of games I have now. I think I might be out of control here.
I said I was out of control like five years ago.
Yeah, it was like maybe 15, 20 games in. I remember. Oh my God, yeah. We were sitting in your basement and you have that little workbench and you were like, look at this, I have a full case now. This might be getting crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you have like what, six rooms full?
I have one bookshelf, but it's very awesome. Chock full. Yeah. No.
That is awesome.
Another thing that I think has changed my perspective on games, at least, you know, for the purposes of this podcast, I'll say. So growing up, I didn't just grow up around NES games. I also grew up around movies, and specifically VHS tapes. And I don't understand why these people have nostalgia for these things, but they do. They like really make it a comeback. But big clunky VHS tapes. Do you remember like the big plastic clamshell cases?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So imagine like literally thousands of those in my basement. So when I say I grew up around movies, like they were like piles of them larger than my head.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, what will we do on the weekends? It's like, what are you going to do? You watch movies because why not? They're everywhere. And so I grew up watching movies and I watched so many damn movies that eventually I got to the point where I was just watching them obsessively and trying to learn not only, you know, which ones were the good ones, but like, why were they good? And I started like picking them apart and I started learning more about filmmaking. And then I went off to college and I did my undergraduate in cinema because I had grown up around these movies and I was just so interested in learning more about them. And I turned that into a job and I worked in that field for about 10 years. I was doing video production and video editing and I loved one aspect of it that I loved was just talking about movies, watching them and talking about them. Because one thing that interested me was that two people could watch a movie and get something completely different out of it. And I think that is the part of my brain that I wanted to exercise again when I started getting back into this hobby, because I had not really experienced that in a very long time. And when I started playing these games again, what struck me in a way that I'd never experienced before was the artistry behind them. Because now I was finally old enough. I was revisiting all these games that I'd grown up with, and I was old enough to appreciate the technical aspect of it and the history of the games, and maybe how a game would change when it would come over from Japan to the United States. You know, how would they localize it? What would be changed? And one thing there that really got me was how games had been made more difficult in many cases because of the rentals market. So I apologize to everybody. That's all my fault, apparently, or my family's fault.
Right.
That's why American NES games were so much more difficult than Japanese games, was because of the rental market.
There's so much of what you just said there to unpack for me, because going back to you standing in your basement full of clamshell movies, I had the same experience with my grandparents. My grandparents had cable, and none of us did, at least the level of cable that they did. So what they would do is my grandfather would go out and he would buy blank VHS tapes and he would just record movies. And he just had this whole gigantic collection of films at his house. So every time we would come over, he'd be like, "You want to watch a movie? I got these 30 new ones that I recorded off of HBO." And I don't know if you're supposed to have done that, but whatever. That was in the 80s and he's no longer with us, so that's fine. But and so I
passed the statute of limitations.
Yeah, right? I think so, 30 years. But I fell in love with movies because of that. And I also got my degree in the same thing. And now I'm still in the video production world. I work as a cinematographer. I am, you know, still shooting video, still editing, doing all that stuff. And it's all because of this huge love of movies that I garnered as a child because of being surrounded by them. And I get your point about wanting to break open that part of your brain again and talk about video games, because I do miss the being able to talk about movies with other people, because the people in my house, they don't give a shit. You know, and like, why do you want to know how the movie was made? Why can't you just watch it and like it instead of like complaining about like the lighting or something like that? It's just not in me. I'm sorry.
You know? Well, and another parallel, I think, between video games and movies that is extremely interesting is one of the areas that I was so interested in college was the history of cinema, mm-hmm. and how they went from a very primitive medium to what we have now. You know, you can trace a line. A very direct line through something like penny arcade movies, where you'd be sticking your face in a box and you drop a penny in and these little cards would flip over and show you like a little guy dancing around for 60 seconds. That was like an early movie. You can draw a line from that all the way up to, you know, Avengers Endgame. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's the progress is... And what is interesting about it to me is that video games have undergone such a similar trajectory that I feel like that's what we've lived through. You know, we lived through the silent era of video games.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we came of age. We came of age in a time where Atari 2600 games, I think the Atari 2600 games are very much like those penny arcade movies, you know, or... Movies used to be silent. They used to be 8 minutes long.
Yep.
You know, and you'd have like a live piano. There's silent movies, but you'd have like live music playing like in the theater. Like, you know, that's like the NES era. And you go all the way up through and, you know, I don't know where we're at now comparatively, but I mean, it's.
Well, I also feel like the evolution of that is like almost exponential, because it took 90 years to go from silent to where we are now. And whereas with the video games, that only took about 35 or 40. So it's kind of interesting.
Right. I'm just speaking relatively here.
I think it's a very important point, because we can't get people who grew up in the silent era to talk to us about movies today. Like, nobody who grew up in the silent era has watched mm-hmm. a Marvel movie. And so it's difficult to get their perspective on things. Whereas we're playing, dare I say it, Fortnite and other games that are not really considered like the top artistic, you know, quality by some people. Sure. And that's really important. It's really important to be able to have that breadth of experience. And I think that lends a lot of credibility to why we believe these homebrew games are so important, because they have a quality and an appeal that even today, knowing that we really enjoy a whole wide range of games from what we've grown up through all the way to the most advanced games that we can play today, that they still have that appeal. They still have something unique to offer that the modern Marvel AAA game quality can't actually match for some reason. Mm-hmm. There's something unique, there's something special, there's something that is difficult to replicate, no matter what your budget is, on a modern 3D hardware that the NES does so well.
Yeah, and sorry, Bart, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remember my brain kind of cracking open when you were like, oh yeah, this is a brand new homebrew game that I just bought. And I was like, wait a second, they're still making games for the NES? And you're like, yeah, they're doing a bunch of people are doing it. And my mind was blown, because for me personally, that was like a door that had slammed shut 30 years ago was being pried open and you could get back into it. You know what I mean? Like, as a child, getting a brand new NES game and like being able to sit down and read the manual and like go through all this stuff and like put it in for the first time and just see how this new game was going to take advantage of whatever the NES had to offer was something that I loved. I mean, I loved it. And when that console died, then, you know, I also was going through old garage sales back in the late 90s, buying every Nintendo game that I could find, for because everybody's grandma was like throwing away their stupid Nintendo. Oh yeah, you can have the whole thing for $15, you know, and you'd end up with 30 games. You know, I'd have a bunch of doubles, so I'd give them to my friends. I did collect back in the 90s. I had a decent sized collection of Nintendo games, and I played as many of them as I could get my hands on, because, you know, it was a thing that had gone away. But when you told me, yes, this is kind of back, people are making games for this old system that you thought was dead, I was like, oh, I have to know more about this. And I think that's kind of the reason I'm here.
Well, and I mean, we've kind of segued into the second section I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, why do we want to make a podcast where we sit down and talk about video games? And I think you guys have both really illustrated why they interest you. To me, as somebody who was collecting for a while, I knew that the homebrew community existed, but I was kind of outside of it because I didn't know where to start. And it wasn't until, honestly, Micromages came along and they had this amazing promotional video where they talked about how to make a game exactly the size of Super Mario Brothers, which I believe, Connor, you can correct me, I believe it's 54 kilobytes. Is that correct?
I don't know the number off the top. I think it's actually a little smaller than that.
If might
I
be smaller than that.
A number.
Yeah, it might be 40. Who knows?
Yeah, it's probably closer.
I say who knows. Like, I could easily look this up, but I'm not going to. But once I saw Micromages, I realized that there was more interesting stuff going on in this homebrew community, and I wanted to get involved in it. And then I came across, honestly, another podcast is The Assembly Line. And if you're listening to this right now and you want to know more about homebrew NES games, just turn this off, because those guys are going to be better than anything we're doing. Fantastic podcast. And at the time of this recording, they've got maybe 20 episodes. It's the only podcast I can say I've ever listened to every episode at least twice. Now, I will say where those guys are coming from, they're both developers for the NES. And so they have that perspective on it. And what I was kind of interested in doing was talking about these games from the point of view of the players, you know, someone who just plays games, who doesn't develop, who doesn't code for the NES or any other console, but just enjoys them and it has an appreciation for them and grew up with these consoles and wants to share those experiences with other people. That's really why I wanted to do this podcast. That's what this is about. And I will say, have you guys ever heard of Ian Bogost?
No.
Connor, have you come across that name?
Not recently.
So Ian Bogost is an author, and he's a game designer, and he's a professor of like film and media studies. He comes at a point of view where he's not only writing about games as someone who plays games and makes games, but like his writing is actually informed by philosophy. And one of the interesting points that he's made over time is that these consoles, these retro consoles, still have creative potential in them. And, you know, you've got this life cycle, I think, with technology where you have these different generations of video games where you've got a new technology and everybody who knows anything about this field comes into it and they try to learn this new console and squeeze every bit of creative juice that they can out of it. And it takes them years and they develop levels of expertise on that one particular platform. And then the technology changes and you switch to the next generation. It might happen after, you know, 7 or 8 years, suddenly people go from the NES to the Super Nintendo, or they go from the PlayStation 2 to the PlayStation 3 or whatever. And all these people have to kind of relearn what they're doing. And so, you know, you've got stuff that's like end of life for the NES, I think had some of the most interesting games. They looked the best, but people weren't playing them in 1994. Mm-hmm. Everybody switched over to Super Nintendo. And so all of these people who had this level of expertise on that one platform, they all have to drop those skills and move on to something else. And what I think is so interesting about Homebrew is that it kind of picks up where those people left off. And it's like, no, there is creative life left in these machines, in these platforms that are no longer being used. The fact that people still make games for these platforms, I find that so damned interesting, because it's just like, no, there is creative potential here. What can we do? And I didn't get around to talking about the kind of games that I like, but my thing is mechanics. That's what I love about games, is I love, because I can sit there, I could watch a movie and it's a passive experience. I can sit there and let it just, I can just let it kind of like wash over my eyeballs and experience the movie. But you don't do that with a game. With a game, you have to pick up something and interact with it. And that's what I find so interesting about good games is, to me, a good game is a game that has very solid mechanics. It's got to start, like, that is the most foundational level. So you guys talked about Nintendo 64, Mario 64. I don't have a lot of fond feelings for that console, but one thing I will say is that while I don't think that game has aged super well, I think the mechanics are fantastic. And the fact that, if I'm remembering the story correctly, they actually spent 2 years just designing Mario and the way that he like interacted with his environment. And that controller for the Nintendo 64 is built around controlling Mario in right. Mario 64. Like that's the kind of like detail that I love. If a game has bad mechanics, I don't care how good it is, mm-hmm. I will not like it. You know, I have a serious problem with that. And likewise, you know, on the flip side, if a game has good mechanics, I will forgive a lot of bullshit. I will forgive a terrible story. I will forgive bad graphics or terrible music or whatever. If a game has good mechanics, then part of my brain is going to enjoy playing it. Okay, did you guys have anything to say about that rant I just went on about?
When I think about squeezing creative potential out of the original Nintendo Entertainment System, I think about, again, that analogy to the silent movies, where if you could go back to the silent movie era and show them Stanley Kubrick and show them Steven Spielberg and show them all these other kind of movies that use techniques that are just way outside of what they were considering at the time, or developed on the things they were considering at the time, and then say, hey, maybe you could use these to make some new, really interesting movies, that might actually be something that they would use. And you can't do that with movies, because it's physically impossible to go back and make movies the same way that those silent movies were made. Like, the technology that was used is literally lost. We cannot go back and do things the same way that they did without being ridiculously expensive. But with Nintendo, it's actually ridiculously cheap. Emulation has made it so feasible for you to go back and use the silent movie techniques of video game development today that you can go and look at a modern game like Grand Theft Auto or Breath of the Wild or whatever and say, oh, that's an interesting idea. I'll make and game myself that is inspired by that. I think that's really remarkable that you can kind of move between these worlds and have this idea of taking inspiration from something that is so high fidelity, but yet using it to develop something that could have been released in 1989 and considered a really standout game in its own right, and still right. have its own unique appeal separate to that inspiration. So
yeah, because I mean, while you can watch silent films today, I'll never have the experience of sitting in a movie theater, you know, with a bunch of people, with a live piano player. Everybody's got their hats on, you know, and they're smoking pipes or whatever. And, you know, it's like 1908 and we're watching The Great Train Robbery or whatever. And, you know, I'll never get to have that experience. I can watch those movies today, but it's just not quite the same thing.
Right.
Whereas, you know, you can still whip out a CRT. Well, you wouldn't whip it out because they're pretty damn heavy. But I mean, you know what I'm saying. You could get a console and you know, put a game on a flash drive and play it on
even deeper
original hardware.
Comparison there, which is, Nick, you and I both lived in San Francisco for a time, though we didn't know each other when we were living there. And there was a movie theater in the Castro Theater, and they had an organ.
Yes.
And that organ was originally made to play music alongside silent movies.
Right.
And it's still functional. People still play music on it to this day. And you could technically make a silent movie to be played in the Castro. And you could technically get somebody to play along on that organ. It's just not feasible. You can't do that. Like you're saying, like it's a CRT screen is within the reach of fairly middle-class person in the United States to say, okay, I'm going to record on the original film that, you know,
right. I mean, you could do something like that. But what is your potential audience? Like, you know, it might be a bunch of hipsters in San Francisco. Whereas with this kind of thing, pretty much anybody can get on Facebook Marketplace and get a CRT and get on eBay and get a NES control deck for $50 and you're ready to go. I mean, that's the experience. That's it. All right. So I think that's probably a good place to wind this one down. So at the end of every episode, what I'd like to do is announce what the next planned episode is going to be. Since this is episode zero and people are listening to this maybe out of order, I don't know how relevant that's going to be, but we will say, so what is our first game? Is it going to be Lizard? Is that the first one we're going to talk about?
I think it's going to be.
All right, it's going to be Lizard.
It's going to be a controversial episode. It's going to be...
We have some differences of opinion. I think that our first episode should be pretty good for that reason. So, yeah, Lizard, you can find out more about that game at lizardnes.com. You can get a physical copy at the 6502 Collective or at Broke Studio. I can't say enough good stuff about Broke Studio. Love those guys. Or you can just get the NES ROM. You can get it on itch.io, or the game is also on Steam. So, yeah, the idea that we've kind of got here is that if you're interested in doing so, you can play along, you know, listen to a podcast episode. Okay, that's the next one they're going to do. I'm going to go play that game. And then when we come back and we're ready to talk about it, you can listen to it along with us.
And be so upset by how our opinions are different than yours.
God, I hate these motherfuckers. They're terrible opinions.
They?
Yes. Yep.
And then you can, you know, email us and tell us how much we suck, because everybody's going to do that.
Yeah, speaking of that, if you want to email us, if you have questions or comments or suggestions for maybe future games that you might want us to talk about, you can email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. You can find us on social media, Twitter and Instagram at HB Game Club. And right now we're working on setting up our YouTube and Twitch and Discord. And so I think Discord's would be really good for this format, because, you know, we can get on there and people can talk as they're playing the games. That could be the game club. I don't know. We haven't quite figured out how we're going to implement that yet, but I'm sure we will soon. Social media accounts. You can follow me, Nick, at DVertov. I am all over the place. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Video Game Sage. Bart, you can find at Clever Username Needed. That's all one word on Instagram. And you can follow Connor at Connor Nash on Twitter if you don't want to hear anything video game related.
Unfortunately,
I'm reading that right off the description.
There's not a lot of video game related material on that Twitter. But if you know, you just think that I'm an eloquent man and I say things nicely, you can follow that if you like.
He's an eloquent man, folks. And that's going to be our first episode. So thanks for listening, everybody. If you like the podcast, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you next time with Lizard. Thank you for listening.
Boo.
That's it. Are we done? Did we really do it? Did we actually finish?
That was it.
Maybe. We'll see how it edits out.
Yeah. We'll see how it edits out. Outro music. Here we go.
That is super generic outro music. I love it.
It sounds like you know what that sounds like? We're gonna do like a business podcast. It's like, hey everybody, yeah. Now we're talking about commercial real estate investing. Welcome.
Right.